And I believe we are recording. So welcome, listeners, to another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches as we start to wind down season two of the podcast of the Armchair Dragoons. And we have with us a pair of special guests tonight. He's been here before to talk about the game design program at the Command and General Staff College, and now he's back to talk in a few more details about it. Dr. James Sterrett, welcome, sir.
Hello.
Hey, what is the official title, like, on your business card there at CGSC?
It's terribly repetitive, I'm afraid, because I work in the Directorate of Simulation Education, and I'm the Chief of Simulation Education.
All right. There we go. I knew it had morphed some over the years, but I wasn't 100% sure what it had landed on lately.
So. It sounds far more impressive than it really is.
Especially since you guys teach in a basement.
We do. It's a nice basement, though.
Yes. Yes, it is. And then also with us, game theorist, Brian Train. Howdy, Brian.
Hi. How are you doing? Yeah. James, it sounds like you got transferred over from the Department of Redundancy Department.
The problem is that, and believe it or not, this is actually relevant to at least one tiny detail in Matt's book, Matt Caffrey's book, is that about 2 years ago, the directorate that we were part of, the Digital Leader Development Center, got broken up. And the Sims division was suddenly left out on its own and told, figure out what your name is. And we flailed for a while and eventually came up with, well, simulation education, because we both provide simulations for education and we educate people about simulation. And then they were saying, well, we're going to have two sections. We're going to have sort of the operations section, and we're going to have the education section. They said, so we're going to call you Chief of Simulation Education. I said, okay.
Well, I think it's significant and obvious at the same time that you guys did not use the word training.
Yes, partly because the CGSC insists, with good reason, that it does education as opposed to training.
Absolutely.
It's trying to teach people how to think instead of exactly what to think.
Yeah, and I think that is quite significant, because that's the point that a lot of people seem to proceed from when they read about how the professional military uses games and war games especially. So that's one of the first, I guess, lines to draw when you're talking then about this kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, the training versus education debate is always fairly entertaining. Without, you know, getting too far into a pedantic rat hole of definitions, my favorite comparison of education versus training was in a wargame discussion online, actually. And I, for some reason, I'm thinking it's Fred Schwartz that made the remark that nobody really has a problem with your kids, you know, in middle school getting a class in sex education, but you'd really have an issue if they had a class in sex training.
That's pretty good.
James, of note, the simulation education does not include any sort of mention of game, does it?
No, although we are steadily sneaking more references in, not least because increasingly war game is not a dirty word, which is a nice revolution to be slowly and steadily occurring.
Yeah, on the podcast released the week before this, like, I have no idea what order the audience listens to this in, we had Rex Brynan join us along with Jim and Doug, and we were talking about various wargame applications of civil military considerations, and the idea that we never quite got to it, but the idea of lots of people want to use the term conflict simulation as a substitution for war game, because it, you know, as Dunnigan noted, it avoids those two pesky words, war and game. The problem is, as we've discussed a bunch before, not all games are simulations and not all simulations are games, but not all conflicts are wars. And so by swapping out that definition a little bit, you've now suddenly significantly broadened what you're talking about. And that's not always a useful thing. So, so for tonight, and one of the reasons we have James here in his official capacity, James mentioned Matt Caffrey's book. Matt Caffrey, he's retired now, isn't he, James?
No, I believe he's still working.
No, but I mean, he's retired colonel.
He's retired as a colonel, but yes. He's still working at the Air Force Research Lab.
Yes, he is colonel retired Matt Caffrey, of the Air Force Research Labs. And so, yeah, you're right. He is still working there. But when I said retired, I meant from the military. Probably should have led with that. He has a book that I believe has been a quarter century in the making at this point. called On Wargaming, that has been released by the Naval War College Press. Is that correct? I think that's the formal organization that's released it. And so Matt is tracking a history of wargaming primarily focused on the military applications of wargaming. As you go through section by section, he's talking about the wargaming that was happening in the DOD, specifically in the U.S., although he does broaden out and look at what were the Brits doing? What were the French doing? What were the Germans, especially the Germans? What were the Canadians doing when the Canadians were doing something? And within the U.S., he gets pretty granular. What was the Navy doing? What was the Army doing? What were the Marines doing? And what were the lessons that they took from those as they move forward? And so for folks that are interested in the professional applications of wargaming, it's a fascinating read. There's some great history in there. And so using Matt's book as sort of the cornerstone of this discussion brought you guys in to talk about some of, you know, that book and some of the other books around wargaming that have been released, because there's been some great ones just in the last few years. Zones of Control was the collection of essays that were released. It's been 4 years now or so, I think. Matt Kirschenbaum, Pat Harrigan, who we've interviewed on a previous podcast. And then Phil Sabin's book, Simulating War, that's been about 7 or 8 years at this point. And Dr. Sabin, obviously, you know, teaching that war studies program over in London. We've got Perla's book. We've got Dunnigan's book. I know I'm missing books. So just a quick note, Brian, do you have a favorite of the war game books that are floating around out there? And is there a reason you would consider that to be a favorite?
I gotta confess, I have downloaded Matt's book. I think it would be a good idea, maybe if it's possible for you to put in like a URL where people can download Matt's book, because it's free.
We've already got it in our forums and on our Twitter feed.
Yeah, I thought you might have. And, you know, he's been getting some quotes, and it's been bouncing around. I haven't had time to do more than skim Matt's book, and I got to confess, the first thing I did was skimming, looking for my name.
Yes. I will say the download is a wonderful thing with that Control-F function.
You know you would do the same thing.
Oh, I did.
Should we confess to having done exactly the same thing? Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. I think a really good place to start is to look at the back of Matt's book, because there's an annotated bibliography in the back of his book, and it's got most of the titles that I think we should be talking about today. There's Dunnigan's book, The War Games Handbook, Peter Perla's book, Andrew Wilson's very old book on wargaming from 1969. That's one of the first published books on the use of professional wargaming, and Philip Sabin's book, of course. I'm surprised that Matt did not put Zones of Control in his bibliography, because Matt actually has a chapter in that book, and it is one of the first really serious anthologies to be produced on board wargame design. Zones of Control was published by MIT Press, and if you look at the MIT Press catalog, you see that they've got a pretty generous selection of titles on game studies. But then you start looking at them and you see, oh yeah, 99% of these are all about computer games. and video games and the sociology of computer games and, you know, queer theory of computer game design and stuff like that. All kinds of stuff, but very, very little on manual games. So I thought it was really significant, you know, that Matt and Kirschenbaum and Pat Harrigan got this thing together. I like it. Zones of Control very much. I find it kind of an uneven book, though. These guys, I think they did a good job editing what came in, but as an anthology, it's really an anthology. It kind of veers all over the place. So it's a really good collection of really eclectic pieces, but it doesn't quite have the same sort of, you know, sort of hang togetheriness or thread that you find in a book like Phil Sabin's Simulating War, which is a really good book about game design and about their uses in education and in history. And Peter Perlis' book, which, of course, is just superb. I often go back when I'm talking to people about war games, you know, from kind of a basic level, and their people are asking, well, you know, how do you design these things? How do they go together? You know, what use are they? I point them to James Dunnigan's book, The Complete War Games Handbook, not only because it is very good, but also because it's out there in PDF format for free. That's another URL you can maybe put in. But he's got a couple of chapters that are very, very useful to people who are interested in the subject and maybe want to get into it a little bit more about, you know, how to play, why to play, how these things get designed. Not long ago, I was at Quantico for a military operations research society conference on urban warfare, and I did a presentation about several games that I've designed on urban conflicts. And I think the first thing that you talk about is, you know, the people want to know is how is this game designed? How do you put it together? What are the steps that a war game goes through? And the first thing you do is I pointed them to a chapter in the Complete War Games Handbook about how the different steps of how these things are designed. Practically all of them are designed, you know, in pretty much the same way, whether they're manual or not. And in comparing the designs that I was talking about in my presentation, I used an acronym that Peter Perley used in one of his lectures. It's not in The Art of Wargaming, but it was another way of looking at the different sort of entities or components of a game and how they relate to each other. So I think that these books that we're going to be discussing, they do have different intended audiences, but there's still a really wide breadth of engagement that somebody could have with any one of these books. There's a little bit of something for everybody in these books. They're not overly specialized. They're not overly technical or highfalutin or academic in their approach. And I think that is really great. But do I have a favorite? That was your question.
That's where we started, but, you know, yeah, we never end up where we meant to go. So
yeah, that's where we started. And I've kind of meandered in a circle, and now I'm headed up my own fundament. I don't know. I have different favorite books for different purposes. So for introductory purposes, you know, James Dunnigan's book, for sort of like the why of board gaming and the uses it can be put to, you know, just sort of in how to approach the world, is Peter Perla's book. If I want to talk about the use of games in education, Philip Sabin's book is excellent. I did a lecture a while ago to a class historicity in war games, and I leaned on Philip Sabin a lot. And Zones of Control is it's a really esoteric collection of bits and pieces, and the lack of theme in the book is not, I didn't mean to put that down as a bad point. It's just the lack of theme makes it easy to kind of just dip in and out of the book.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can find all kinds of things in there as well. So I'm glad that they went for a really, really wide, you know, they cast the net really wide in soliciting chapters from people. You know, you and James and I, we know maybe half or two-thirds of the people, you know, who are in the anthology. But there's an awful lot more, you know, there's an awful lot of new names that I'd never encountered before in that book as well.
Yeah, I think for Zones of Control, there's three groups of people in there for that several of us can fall into. One of them is I've worked with these people before, you know, where I've actually, you know, worked on a conference panel or worked on an actual war game design with some of these folks. There's a group of people in there that I, quite frankly, I have never heard of. And then there's the third group of people who are people I've probably gotten drunk with at a convention somewhere. And those are sort of the three separate groups of people all represented in Zones of Control. One of the better descriptions that I've heard of it, and I totally ripped off this term for an article I wrote about it, was, you know, we've all been to the Connections Conference over the years, and we've written some about it, and Brian, you've written AARs for us elsewhere, that, you know, it is the professional military wargaming conference, where that overlap of hobbyists and practitioners get together to talk about what can we do, how can we do it better, how can we help each other. And it's an academic conference, but a very chummy one. And Zones of Control really reads like the greatest hits of the last 10 years of the Connections Conference. That if you broke it down to sort of the proceedings of each individual conference, you'd have maybe 8 or 10 of the articles out of Zones of Control each year, but collecting them and culling them over the course of 10 to 12 years, you'd end up with a book like Zones of Control. And I think it's a solid, wide-ranging representation of what the hobby has. And so I think the scope really does it justice that well. Even the chapters I didn't enjoy much, I can still find utility in them being there. Sorry. Is somebody scraping around in the background there somewhere? Or is that just me?
Sorry, I was just flipping some pages. I just wanted to remark, too, that the Zones of Control is it's a transatlantic and, well, transoceanic kind of anthology as well, because you have writers like Nakamura from Japan and a good selection of British writers as well. So I know that we have, you know, Connections now has a British franchise, and it was good to see that there are, you know, all kinds of different contributions from different countries as well.
So, James, I know you use a handful of these in the curriculum. Before we dive too far into which books you use and how you use them within the curriculum, do you have a personal favorite or one that you've really enjoyed over the years that you would care to share about?
Well, much like Brian, the answer is yes, but, because they're all different and they've all got their different strengths and weaknesses. But other than simply saying everything Brian said, the other things that I would put in as notes. First, one of the things that quietly charmed me about Zones of Control that perhaps most people would not have noticed was the fact that we had an article in it I had nothing to do with making the book, from Robert Cetino, who is a professional practicing historian of some note in the military history field. And when I went into that field, I was quietly advised to keep my wargaming tightly, strictly under wraps. And seeing his name pop up, Phil Sabin I had heard of, so I wasn't surprised, but seeing him pop up was, for me, a sign that possibly that field was starting to let its hair down ever so slightly. And I agree that simultaneously the great and terrible thing about Zones of Control is the breadth that it's got. There's something for everybody, and therefore there are going to be some articles in it where you say, why was this here? And yet I'm sure that across the aisle in the library, you're going to find somebody who's saying that article was the greatest thing in it. So it goes. I guess of a book that we have not mentioned yet, but that in this field winds up having a particularly warm spot in my heart, is Raph Koster's A Theory of Fun for Game Design.
Love that book.
Which is, which is the most stolen book I have ever bought and bought and bought, because I've probably bought the better part of half a dozen copies over the years, and they keep on walking because people like it. At some levels, it seems very light. The book is half cartoons. It's a very easy read. It's really, really well written. But Koster makes a very powerful case for the nature of learning in games and the fact that the reason that we like games is the fact that we are learning, that it's tickling the same reward circuit that any other learning does in your brain, and that we stop being interested in a game when we stop having anything to learn from it. It's why none of us want to play tic-tac-toe against anything other than, say, a small child who has not yet learned that tic-tac-toe is completely and utterly broken as a game. I assign that, I know you didn't want to go into this yet, but I do assign that to my students, and every year students say, hey, this was great, it was fun, and it's lit their brains up. So while it's not war games per se, it is games in general. That's a book that I've got a warm spot for, I suppose. If you made me say there's a favorite, then I probably would point at that.
Well, one of the great things about Koster's book.
I haven't found anybody yet to steal a copy from, so I have to look out for that. I'll probably have to obtain my copy legitimately.
Oh, man, Brian, how are you going to live?
He's Canadian. That's how they do things.
If you want to be super cheap about it, the original version of the book Koster had up on a website once upon a time, and I assume, I don't actually know that it's still up there. That was the draft for the first edition of the book. The second edition of the book is fairly significantly expanded. And it's not like it's terribly expensive. I don't remember offhand what it costs, but I'm sitting in front of a computer. I could find out.
I read that book as a part of my PhD studies 13, 14 years ago now. The beauty of it, as you mentioned, it's sort of half cartoon. It's one of those every two-page spread, one side is an illustration, the other side is the content. And the content is not in very dense little bitty four-point type. It is very readable. And quite frankly, the average reader, the average member of our audience who's probably above an above average reader will knock it off in 2.5 hours, cover to cover. It's a very engaging book, as you've mentioned. It's a fun read. It's an illuminating read. It's a fast read. And I dare say anyone who is serious about game design should give it a read. Cause again, what's it going to cost you? 2.5 hours one afternoon? But the way it boils down some fairly complex ideas to really simple questions, I think Koster's done a great job of getting to the heart of game design issues, as you mentioned.
Maybe I'd like to mention another favorite of mine that doesn't have much to do exactly with war games, but it's another sort of basic text in game studies, and that's Critical Play by Mary Flanagan, whose work I think is really interesting. Critical Play is all about using games as criticisms, of society, of politics, of a lot of things. It doesn't center so much on computer games, although they get a lot of play in there, but it talks about subversions of the forms and intent of board games, that sort of thing. Mary Flanagan also wrote the final chapter in the Zones of Control anthology, and it's a really good piece about her reactions to playing war games. So I would recommend that as well. And Critical Play, it's pretty easy to find. It's in a lot of libraries, university libraries.
Yeah, I do want to make a note as we go further into this discussion of books on games and books on gaming. One of the things I do want to make note about is that we did agree before all of this started, or sort of, you know, I threw out there, let's stay away from books that are strictly sets of rules, right? We don't want to talk about the H.G. Wells' Little Wars. You know, we're talking about books that examine the breadth and depth of the hobby, or its professional applications, books on design, books that sort of explain how war games work and what they are and what we get out of them, not, hey, here's how to play the game. Although some of the books do include some of that, Phil Sabin's Simulating War has some explanations of how some games are played. Dunnigan's War Games Handbook is it Drive on Mets? Is that the one that's in there?
Yes.
Yeah, it's got a basic one in there, but that's, we were intending to stay away from simply talking about here are the rules for the game. So we did try to stay away from that. James, we have talked before about sort of what is this curriculum like and what do the students get going through it. And so we'll link back to that podcast from this, once we post it. So without going too far back over well-trod ground, what are some of the readings that you give your students and why are those readings key for what you're teaching them?
I use Koster as the introduction, in part because I want to make sure that none of the students are going to say, well, all this gaming stuff is nonsense and we're going to walk away from it. So, in a sense, I use Koster to try and break their heads open and make them open to the newer stuff we're going to throw at them. And their reaction to Koster is, I'm tempted to say universally, but the honest thing is probably almost universally, very positive. Students seem to really like it, in part because it's an easy read. The other three things that I wind up assigning, depending on the course, depending on what's there, if you're in the master's program, then you'll have all four of these assigned, is Peter Perla, because they need that foundation. It's, in a sense, it's the general theory book. And is also Phil Sabin's Simulating War, because that is the practical book that accompanies the game design class. And I tell them in that they're going to read the first two sections, and then they're going to read the most relevant of the worked example sections, because in addition to me jabbering at them in class and showing them examples, it's Phil Sabin jabbering at them through the book, reading, they can read his writing through the book, and have it reinforced. The fourth is the Defense Wargaming Handbook from the UK, which I guess is another thing that I would hold up to people and say, hey, you really ought to read this. It's short. It's concise. It is really well written.
And they spell defense with a C.
They do. The British do that.
As do we.
And after living for 3 years in Canada and 5 years in the UK, all as an adult, I no longer know how defense is spelled. I type it and one or the other comes out. If Word complains, then I listen to it.
Yeah. So call it late for dinner.
But those are the things that I wind up assigning. And I don't wind up assigning anything out of Zones of Control, in part because I don't want to assign them tiny tidbits of a book that then they have to lug around. I didn't want to give them the sense that there's more that they were going to have to read than they needed to. And frankly, when I'm making the book purchase requests, if I say, yeah, I'm going to use one chapter out of this or two chapters out of this, then it's more of a stretch than if I say, hey, I want them to read the entire book. Please buy 32 copies of this and put it on the reserve shelf in the library. So in the end, I decided not Zones of Control. I've got a copy of it sitting in my office. I'm happy to loan that out to people as long as they sign it out on the whiteboard. And strangely enough, it tends to come back. But it is not something I assigned any more than John Peterson's Playing the World, which is includes a great history of the development of wargaming in Kriegsspiel. I don't make the library buy 32 copies and put it on reserve so that they read that history. Admittedly, one of the things that has gone through my head since Matt has effectively superseded it with On Wargaming is that I may make them download On Wargaming and read at least those chunks.
Sure, Matt will appreciate it.
I'm sure he would. But Mike Dunn, my co-teacher, and I, he and I are both looking through On Wargaming and pondering how it is we're going to try and use it. The question about whether or not we're going to use it is actually pretty much settled. We're just figuring out how and why. Part of the trick is that, for all that I realize, I'm assigning, in some cases, entire books. I try to make sure that I don't assign anything that I can't defend to the students as being not a waste of their time.
Yeah.
I got to be able to look the student in the eye and say, yeah, I really do honestly fully believe that this is useful for your education on this topic. Go read it. I'm not placing an onerous demand on your time. I'm not going to waste your time. Please don't skip the homework.
Have either of you ever looked into either of the books from Katie Salen and Eric Zimmerman, Rules of Play and then The Game Design Reader?
I've certainly read Rules of Play. I read it with an eye towards whether or not I would use it in the course, any of my courses. And it's a great book if you're going to do a general game design course.
Yep.
But as a war game textbook, I didn't think it was as useful as Saban.
I started to read Rules of Play, and around the same time, I was interrupted by my buying a copy of Phil Saban's book. I got it soon after it came out. And I have to agree with James. And I, you know, just reading through Philip Saban's book, you know, and comparing it to Rules of Play, I thought, you know, in either case, it was too late for me. I had been ruined.
Yeah, I think
I've been designing for far too long. You know, it's kind of like my way of sort of outsider art. You know,
as a side note. After the first year of the MA program, during the AAR I held with the students to find out what they thought we needed to improve, one of the pieces of unsolicited commentary was that the students, one of them brought it up, and they all nodded up and down and agreed, is that Peter Perla is Clausewitz, and Saban, they said, was Jomini, because Perla was giving them the overarching theory, and then Saban was giving them the nitty-gritty, and this is how you do it, and you put it into action. So I had the opportunity to tell Peter Perla this, and he was most amused.
Now you have to fly to England to tell Saban.
I will. And one of these days we'll figure out how to get Mike or me off to Connections UK.
Yeah, I would definitely agree that for general game design, Salen and Zimmerman are definitely more applicable than any of the war game books that we're talking about here. I read both of the Salen and Zimmerman books, again, back in my grad school studies, where it was actually, you know, relevant and useful. But it's not, James, you're dead on. It's not something that I think wargame specific students would necessarily find a lot of utility in if you've got something like Saban's book or one of the others available to you. I did want to ask, we've talked a bunch about the books. There are a variety of different game design and game theorist kinds of articles on wargaming out there. Martin Van Clavelt wrote one of the most atrocious history of wargaming articles I've ever written. James, we've talked about this before. We've chuckled over this one before. But the flip side of it is, you know, I have no words and I must design, right?
That is a great article.
Yes.
It is.
And so I would almost say that, that's like that. That's item number one in any game design curriculum. Is here's this article, read this in the 5 minutes we're opening class with, and then we'll discuss, because it doesn't even take that long to read. But Kosticki, I almost think is sort of a requirement in any serious game design discussion. Brian, what do you think?
I definitely agree. Kosticki is great. I mean, he started with SPI and board war games, but he got he seemed to have made his career into computer games. But he's designed so many different kinds of games too, role playing games and you know, as well as computer games. He's not afraid to play around with formats and approaches, and he is, you know, he writes very excessively. And he's very thoughtful in what he says. I wanted to mention, since we mentioned Kosticki, from MIT Press, they have another series of small books on game studies called the Playful Thinking Series. And Kosticki has a book in there called Uncertainty in Games. And it deals with you know, computer games and board games as examples. But what he has to write about uncertainty and sort of fog of war and, you know, trying to deal with the unexpected and how to put that into a game and how to make that work, how it works for the players. Again, that's another good book.
That was the topic. He had a chapter in Sons of Control to that effect, didn't he? I haven't read the book version, but I'm sure I've read an article somewhere by him on exactly that topic. So.
Yeah, the book is a bit thicker than the chapter, so it might be an expansion of those ideas. But certainly it's a good piece, and it's a pretty quick read too.
Yeah, his chapter in Zones of Control is The Unfulfilled Promise of Digital War Games. And so it in typical Kostikian fashion, I want to conduct a thought experiment with you, but to do so, I must transport you to a different time and place, and goes on from there. He is in there, and that is sort of generally where he's going with it. Interestingly, that back section where Kostikian is, the other guys in there start to turn into a list of people I got drunk with at game conventions. I think some of the articles out there are certainly ones that could have, and in some cases should have, wound up in some books like the No Words one. Thankfully, Clayveld's article has never ended up anywhere in a book. And no, we're not going to link to it because it's atrocious. You could write a very solid essay on the history of war games that is built entirely around all of the important war games that he totally left out of his article. James, within your curriculum, we talked some about the ones that you require folks to read. Are there others that students have sort of discovered on their own and come back to you and said, hey, what do you think of this? And you were sort of alternately gratified or horrified that they'd run across them somewhere along the way?
No, because usually, and in the neither gratified nor horrified, they will come periodically with other books. One of the common ones that they stumble across one way or another is Rules of Play. And I'll tell them, feel free to read it. I'm not going to turn you away. The other one that they commonly, oddly enough, bump up against is Jesse Schell's Art of Game Design, A Book of Lenses, which, again, it's a really neat book. It's a book designed to take somebody who knows kind of their way around game design and provide you with a series of challenges to make you think, hey, how am I going to handle this? How do you handle that? How do you approach this? So I'm always happy to hear that they're doing wider reading. But it hasn't convinced me to knock something off its throne as being the one that's officially assigned. Mike and I often refer to both the readings that we assign and to the games that get played in some of the various classes as being the winners of the cage matches. Because there's so little time that for any one thing to be added, something else has to be taken away. So there's dozens of games, certainly, and probably dozens of books and articles that we sit there and say, oh, now this would be great. We can assign it for X. And then we sit there and think about it and say, okay, if we assign this, then it means taking what away? What loses? And that's where the cage match comes in. And things do periodically lose over time and get replaced by something else. And the classes become better as a result. But we try not to be simply saying, here, we'll wheel up the dump truck and throw it all at them, because at some point, if you throw too much at the students, they are human beings, they will stop reading it because they've got other things to do in their lives.
They're human beings. I thought they were mid-career officers.
Now.
I suppose they will have to decide on something they want to stop doing if they're going to be full career officers.
Yeah, same thought seems to be one of the...
So the other jokes that always come out, of course, is that the Command and General Staff College is the short course, and you don't want to go to the other side of post into the prison for the long course. And to our great entertainment, and for a number of years, we've used a photograph of this in the class that we do on dealing with contracts, contractors, and government civilians for our simulation officers. The MP unit that runs the prison has its little motto and crest outside the prison, and their motto is, our mission, your future. Which always seems a little ominous. So we show that at the beginning of this class and say, we're trying to keep you out of their hands.
I do hope it is an effective lesson for them.
Actually, James, I was curious. Has the CGSC always been in Leavenworth?
Yeah, it has. It's gone under, I do not remember all of the names, but I know that at the beginning it was the School of the Line, and then changed at some point into Command and General Staff College, and I am a bad member of my institution and do not remember offhand the full litany of names and when it changed from which to which. But yeah, it's always been at Fort Leavenworth.
Seems to me that that may have been a deliberate choice because the landscape around there is so unremarkable. It would concentrate the mind on studies.
Well, I suppose, although we have actual hills, unlike what you get if you go even further into Kansas.
Yeah, the one of the things you find out on the Great Plains, and this is true of Leavenworth, Kansas, this is true of Fort Sill, Oklahoma, this is true of many of those Great Plains installations. They might be in a middle of nowhere sort of location or an out of the way, you know, what the hell are they doing out here kind of place. But wherever they are on the nicest patch of whatever the hell are we doing out here kind of place. You know, Leavenworth is up against the river. Fort Sill's got, you know, the creek back there and, you know, a little bit of actual terrain running through it. Fort Riley does actually have hills and not just a whole lot of, you know, flat bowling alley. So that is something you notice out on the plains.
Fort Leavenworth is also at the site of the crossing point for the Missouri River.
Yep. So I've always thought Fort Leavenworth was a reasonably scenic base relative to, you know, most of what the Army has in places like Hinesville and Fayetteville and Augusta. And so
it has a reputation as being one of the nicer postings in the Army.
Yeah. And reasonably well deserved. Yeah, because Brian, it's right up against the Missouri state line. It's on the far east end of Kansas. And in fact, I dare say probably a good half of the civilians there probably live in Missouri, don't they, James?
Yep. Yeah. Including me.
Well, I stand corrected then.
Yeah. Fort Riley certainly meets many of the descriptors that you're having in your head there. One of the things that I think I really enjoyed about the Zones of Control book relative to things like Simulating War, Complete War Games Handbook, or some of the other non-war game game design books is Zones of Control dug into some of the academic ideas around the wargaming world without simply turning into a primer on how to design games. And I think that was a useful thing. What are some of the cognitive models that we bring to bear on wargaming? What are some of the things we can learn out of this? What are some of the different thought processes that people bring into this that aren't simply how do I design a game for XYZ purpose or how do I make a player suspend some disbelief when in a role in a game? And I thought that was an interesting approach with Zones of Control that I actually enjoyed in some of those essays in there.
I definitely agree. I mean, I never approach this and Zones of Control, the anthology, with any kind of idea of it being a guide to game design or anything.
No, certainly not.
The most interesting parts in the book to me are the commentary on what these things are for and how they're used and how they treat of different topics. Like the chapter or the part of the book that I'm in on irregular war, I think is great because there's articles in there by all kinds of really thoughtful people on a topic that really, you know, I mean, you've heard me gob off about this before, about how undergamed and just underappreciated this whole area of actual warfare is, irregular war. So I was glad that there was, there's a good, you know, six, eight sections in that part of the book.
Yeah, well, where I think it's important with Zones of Control, approaching those things, you know, like you said, it's great that those are there, is that so many of the other books are, if they're not direct how-to guides like Simulating War, they're broader overarching how-to guides like Perla's book. And James, you mentioned that earlier, you know, the Clausewitz on one end, you know, like the nitty-gritty details on the other. And but they're still essentially talking about how do I design these things. And I think that was one of the cool things about Zones of Control, is that it was analyzing without simply showing you how to design things. And I realize that's not where your course goes, where the professional side of this goes for you. But I think for the casual reader looking for what am I going to get out of these books, I think that's one place where Zones of Control definitely differentiates itself from some of the other books that we've talked about.
In a perfect world, then I would be able to sign more of the wider examinations in Zone of Control to my students. Because in a perfect world, we would have more time, and they would have, therefore, the opportunity to read more widely and consider beyond the immediately practical, so to speak, of what they were doing. But at the same time, in such a perfect world, I would also be insisting that they all take a course in basic probability and statistics. So there are many things that, given worlds enough and time, I would inflict upon my students.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that any of these things are bad. It's more to point out that getting into the more theoretical or the wider theoretical, like the Mary Flanagan article that Brian brought up earlier, is not a bad thing. And there is a real layer at which, if you're going to be a professional in this, then you need to keep your eyes open on more than simply the narrow, how do I do the statistics to figure out my CRT? You've got to be aware of the implications of your design. You've got to be aware that every design is, in fact, an essay, is an argument, in the same way that any history book or any other book of nonfiction winds up being, and arguably even fiction winds up being, an argument. And you need to be alive to what it is that argument is, in fact, saying, and whether or not it's really saying the things that you intend or not.
I gotta say that when I finally got my physical copy of Zones of Control and looked through the table of contents and saw, you know, the pieces that everyone had contributed, my feeling definitely was, this is a book whose time has come. You know, it was time for a book like this to come out.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. So we've sort of jokingly thrown out there that we've gone through the digital copy of Matt's book long enough to simply search for ourselves.
I've in fact managed to read the whole thing, but it ate a substantial chunk of my weekend.
Yeah, so that was my question, was how much actual reading of it have you done? I've done most of the first section, the sort of pre-World War I stuff up through World War I, and then, you know, searching for myself. But not much more than that.
I feel that I've kind of skimmed through it already, because two or three times at Connections, I've sat through Matt's introduction to the history of wargaming, which is kind of the framework for this book. And, of course, every time Matt would, like at every succeeding conference, Matt would do the presentation, but every time the presentation got longer and longer as he, you know, added detail and did more research. So I feel like I've kind of skimmed it already, not just for my name, but just, you know, skimmed it for structure. But I'm really, really looking forward to going through, you know, the details and the historical anecdotes and just the progressions that he traces out. It's a really remarkable and remarkably thorough piece of history.
Yes.
Yeah. It's currently the state of the art on the history of wargaming for the first half of the book. Mm-hmm. And the second half, he really shifts gears and... The first half of the book is, in a sense, thematically coherent. He's writing a history of wargaming, and as he's doing it, he's trying to make a case that wargames win wars. It's his usual tagline of, hey, wargaming saves lives, so let's do it right. And I'm ready to sign up to that tagline. I think he's correct. The second half is much more diverse and sort of choppy in a sense, in that he starts going into chapters that are aimed at, hey, this is how you do this task. Here's thoughts on how you do this task. Here's thoughts on how you use war games in this way, that way, the other way. And it's a, it, in a sense, goes from the relatively theoretical, historical, you know, hey, this is why they're useful, to much more practically oriented chapters. It's got a very great thematic and a shift in tone between the two. And that's not a complaint. It means that there's, in a sense, two books in one, and explains why it's double sized in its thickness. But
yeah.
Yeah, I really wasn't 100% sure what that was in my mailbox, but it weighed about as much as Zones of Control, and so I was a little concerned. And then my wife saw it and said, what the heck is that, and why did you order another book? And until I pointed out that that was my comp copy that Matt sent me for review purposes. I'm not 100% sure she believed me until I threatened to open up the email that he had sent me for, hey, your book is on the way. At that point, I think she finally bought it. But yeah, it's, I think your characterization is pretty solid of two books in one, just from sort of skimming the table of contents, you can see that. You know, Brian, you mentioned having heard a lot of the first part of the book at different Connections conferences. Folks who have been at the Origins War College over the years have heard the second half of the book evolve over the years through a variety of Matt's talks. So you're not the only one who's noticed that.
Well, that's the admonition. Write what you know. And Matt certainly knows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and definitely. It also means that he's had a chance to, in a sense, practice the presentation and figure out what explanations work and what explanations don't work. So it's helped him polish the thing. I don't regard this as a weakness of the book.
No. I just, given how many of the other books are sort of almost how-to guides, I wonder if folks reading the first half of Matt's book aren't going to sort of wonder, when do you get around to the how-to stuff without jumping ahead or sort of jumping around a little in the topic. So I hope folks stick with it because it is a good read. There's a lot of, I mean, look, you put a quarter century into something, you better have it pretty well detailed, huh? So, Matt had joked forever that, you know, within a week of him turning in the manuscript, he was going to have to start working on the addendum. So,
well, there's a layer which is true. Parts of it are already falling out of date, not least because for a variety of reasons that really were not only well beyond Matt's control, but in a lot of ways beyond the control of the editorial staff at the Naval War College Press, it was 2 years from him submitting the manuscript to them to it getting published. And there'd be this endless chain of emails from Matt saying, well, they say that it's now, you know, second, third, first in the list, but you know, an admiral wanted something published, so now it's being bumped and it won't get back into the queue for another 6 months. And this happened a couple times to the point where it was starting to become sort of a running joke of, you know, when will they actually get around to publishing this book that is, it's ready to go. But the flip side of that, though, is that he sent out an email today, yesterday, saying that apparently they are close to selling out on the first printing of it within a very short period of time, weeks, days, and they've already signed it up for a second printing.
Which is good, because they've got me attributed to the wrong website in the back of it. That was part of that whole Control-F thing. Yeah, they've got me affiliated with my former online home, not the current online home, not the Armchair Dragoons, home of the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast you're busy listening to. So yeah, that was good for a chuckle. A wry chuckle, but a chuckle nonetheless.
That's good news, because I was kind of despairing of getting a physical copy, because Matt had mentioned that, it was going to have a very small physical print run. And I thought that I was just going to ever get the PDF. Speaking, actually, of how long it takes things to get to press, I thought at this time it might be a good idea to mention John Curry and his History of Wargaming project. Now, you guys are familiar with some of the stuff that John Curry does, but he is remarkable for turning out loads and loads of titles of books about wargaming. A lot of them are really books of rules or older game designs or commentaries on wargaming personalities of who have passed on, like Patty Griffith or Donald Featherstone. So John's part mission is to kind of chronicle through republishing the history of wargaming. But he also turns out some really interesting books that are kind of collections that are, contemporary to the time of what's going on in wargaming that's new. Like an example is a couple of years ago, he turned out a book called Innovations in Wargaming. And it's got 6 or 7 chapters on different kinds of games using different formats. So not just matrix games, but also committee games, black games, those kinds of things. And John can turn these things out pretty quickly because he just puts the manuscript together and they're published through, Lulu.com, which is like a print-on-demand outfit. So he can have something out there pretty quickly. And he's got a really large and really eclectic selection of titles, and they're not very expensive. So maybe that's another URL that we could put up.
Probably. You guys keep posting them in the chat for this whole call that we're busy recording, so I'll have to go back and hope that they are all preserved in the chat, that I can cull them to stack them all up. We're getting close to our 1 hour mark, and so I did want to sort of wrap this thing up a little bit. We've covered a variety of the different books that, again, we wanted to stay away from just pure rule books, and we wanted to talk about books that are a greater examination of the hobby. And we've strayed a little from wargaming because there are some that are still good for wargamers, even though they're not strictly books on wargaming. But if you were going to put a book in front of somebody or an article or something about wargaming for someone who didn't know anything about wargaming, is there a particular piece? Obviously the best way to show them how wargaming works is to sit down and play a wargame with them and sort of show them how it actually works by doing it. But is there a particular article that you would recommend for someone who doesn't know anything about wargaming, who's unfamiliar with the hobby or the profession, that it is a good one to give them as a primer? James, what do you think?
I'm much more partial to the notion of make them play a game. And the game that we use as the intro, that I use as the intro to wargaming, is the Battle for Moscow, the old Frank Chadwick design, which was purpose-built as a introductory war game. I love using it at the beginning of the game design class because it's not simplistic, but it is simple. So they can grasp it, they can play through it in 30, 45 minutes. What I typically expect is that we'll get through, for those of you who are familiar with the game, to the point where mud hits as the Germans are driving on Moscow, at which point you've seen a simple version of a remarkable number of war game systems in that one game that I can keep on pointing back to as we run through discussions. Hey, you remember we had an asymmetric sequence of play. There were replacements. There were step losses. There were hexes with terrain. There was weather. And they can say, oh, okay, so I can see a way to incorporate those things. And it tends to work very well. If you give me the time to ramble on, then I will ramble on about this topic at great length, because inevitably the brown bag serious games wargaming events that we run at CGSC are aimed really at the assumption that people will come to them not necessarily having played a war game before, and we're going to put in front of them something that's got sufficient meat on its bones that it will be interesting, and we've figured out how to teach it so that they will learn it fast and have a good time and hopefully come back and do it more.
The last time you were on the podcast talking about the master's program in the game design studies and the things that you do there, we said, hey, we're going to have you back on the podcast to talk about this whole brown bag lunch series. And then we never scheduled you to come back to talk about the Brown Bag Lunch Series. So maybe next time we'll actually get you to talk about the Brown Bag Lunch Series and fulfill our promise of 6 months ago.
You know where to find me.
Yes. Yes, I do. Brian, now that James has rambled for a moment, is there, absent the obvious answer of make them play a game, is there something that jumps out at you as, hey, this is a great article to sort of be an intro to wargaming or something along those lines?
I'm sorry, I have to disappoint you and agree with James. Probably the best thing to do is to get somebody to play something. I don't know about Battle for Moscow. There are lots of different, you know, simple but not simplistic war games that you could use. I think in any case, whether you're going to sit somebody down, you know, to play a game or to get them to read something about it first, you need to know a little bit more about their motivations. Does somebody just want to know, is this, I enjoy games. I played Risk once. Is this something that I would want to get into? Or is someone really interested into military history, for example, and, oh, I'm, you know, now here's a way of going through the history that is maybe more interesting than, you know, reading a book that turns out the same way, no matter how many times I read it. So I don't know. I'd have to think about what their motivation would be for wanting to know. And I could make a suggestion based on that. I think probably in terms of style and just kind of being able to write at a level that would interest somebody who's really kind of a neophyte is probably something by James Dunnigan. James Dunnigan has written lots and lots of sort of introductory notes and short articles for different books and magazines and so forth on wargaming, and he's got a very plain, blunt style. I mean, you know, we've been in the room, we've listened to him speak, that I think would probably be good. So I try and find something by him I think would probably fit the bill, but a precise article doesn't come to mind right now.
Yeah.
Second, if I can, I'm going to second Brian's comment that if you're going to find something that someone's going to enjoy, the most critical feature is that it's on a topic they're already interested in.
Yeah, it's like, with the coin system, for example, the GMT coin system, everybody, you know, posts on Board Game Geek saying, well, I've heard a lot about this system, and I've heard Cuba Libre is the one to get into because it's short, and it's, you know, this kind of thing, and is it really the one that I want? And I think the better answer is go with a historical topic that really arouses your interest. Because if you're not interested in the topic and you'll find reasons to dislike the treatment, and whether it's the shortest game in the series or not, it's going to feel like a long slog if you're just not interested in what it is that you're, you know, the ideas and the history that you're supposed to be exploring.
Yeah, that brings up a whole separate chain of conversation that we could be having about the variety of inane answers that appear either at Board Game Geek or in the Wargamers group on Facebook. As soon as somebody says, hey, I want to buy a war game, what should I get?
Yep.
Right? I've got a friend who's interested in wargaming. What should I use for a first war game?
Yeah.
And you've got to go like 37 answers deep before you get to the, well, what historical period do they like? Because at this point, you can find a good introductory game for just about damn near any war you're looking for.
Yeah, well, the universal, that's kind of the universal inane answer to the universal inane question is you've got to find something that you're interested in. And really, that is why I started designing games in the first place. I started designing games because nobody was designing games on the topics, the historical topics and treatments that I was interested in. So, you know, I started to roll my own.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would argue that the ultimate inane answer to that question is actually the chucklehead that thinks he's being funny by always answering Case Blue.
What is the origin of that joke anyway?
Hang on a minute, because I happen to know very well somebody whose first war game was a OCS title.
Well, you're married to her.
I am married to her.
Well.
And that's because, for those who don't know the story, we were dating, and I got in a comp playtester copy of Enemy at the Gates, and she looked at it in the shrink wrap, read the back of it, and said, I've got to learn to play this. And I said, absolutely, let's go.
Yeah. Now, All right. Before we get too far down this rabbit hole here, let's also acknowledge that your wife is one of the Uber history nerds of Uber history nerds.
Yes.
So
she has a PhD in history. So
yeah, she was already, and not just that, but it's not a PhD in military history, right?
Technically, the degree is in modern history, but the topic was the professionalization of the British Army Officer Corps from 1870 to 1904.
Yeah, I didn't think the official title was military history, but that's actually what she's done a ton of. So, yeah, and that's the whole thing, is that you've got somebody who's not just an uber nerd about history, but specifically military history, so she was already... Like, right in the target market for wargaming, as it is.
The wider point is that interest will trump complexity every time.
Yeah, yeah.
If somebody is fascinated by the topic, lots of fiddly little rules on it, assuming the game is well-designed and the fiddly little rules reflect the reality that they're aware of, they're going to say, oh, all the fiddly little rules make sense, and they'll be perfectly happy.
Yes, yeah. Brian, to your point, the origin of where this whole thing comes from, I think somebody just thought they were being funny because Case Blue is an overly complex and massive game. The problem that I have with the guys that think they're being funny is that there's always going to be the one newbie that hits Board Game Geek and looks up Case Blue and goes, why the heck is this the new one? And is that really the best foot we want to put forward for someone who's new to the hobby? Right? Let's open up by being dicks.
Jokes, isn't it? It's the splaining.
Yeah. And that's always rankled me, you know. Got it. You think you're being funny. You're sort of mugging for your own in crowd here, but let's not open up welcoming somebody to the hobby by being a jerk to them. So.
Yep. Yeah. Gatekeepers everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Guys, we're a little over an hour here. I don't want to take up any more of your time, especially, well, Brian, it's dinner for you, but it's pretty late here for us on the East Coast.
I ate already.
So, but yeah, thank you guys both for joining us. James, one of these days we will get around to recording a podcast on your brown bag.
All right.
What would be fun is let's do it during the brown bag so you can tell us what's going on in the background.
Ooh, that would be challenging.
Yeah, probably not.
simply getting it. The problem is that the room is not, that we run them in is not in fact shielded, but it acts as if it's shielded. Getting a network connection for cell phones in there is just terrible.
Yeah, I know. It's because you're buried in the basement.
Yep.
My cell phone battery has never died faster than it did down in your guys' office. trying to find a signal in vain. Brian, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. We'll have to find time to have you back again on Mentioned in Dispatches in a future season. We just got to work out the clock so that you're home and we're still awake when we record.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk with you guys. And thank you for staying up late. Well, maybe it's not too late for me. Certainly, you know, if you ever do this on the weekend, I'm more flexible about time. Just, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, we record them on weeknights and the audience listens whenever they get around to listening. And so we appreciate them doing that whenever they do.
Yep.
Folks, fans, friends, we're again wrapping up season 2 of Mentioned Dispatches here real shortly. We do appreciate you listening and checking us out, and we hope that you swing by the site and you know, leave us some thoughts, leave us some commentary, have a discussion on some games with us, and we hope to, you know, we aspire to our online discussion being at least as erudite as we can be on the podcast, and we usually fail miserably. Let's face it. But we do thank you for taking the time to join us here. And, guys, appreciate you guys giving up some time to talk to our audience. With that note, goodbye everybody, and we'll see you on another episode later.